From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, we explore China's relations with Russia and Ukraine. China's top legislative body aims to push reform. A Hong Kong journalist provides perspective on tensions with mainland Chinese residents. These stories and more on this Wednesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. As tensions continue to grow in Ukraine, Russia says China supports its military actions there. But as Shannon Van Sant reports from Beijing, the Chinese government's comments on the crisis have been muted.
As the crisis in Ukraine unfolds with Russian military troops fanning out around Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, Russian diplomats have asserted that China supports Russia's actions there. Throughout this week, China's comments on the situation have been muted. Qinggang, China's foreign ministry spokesperson, said China believes in non-interference in internal affairs and is taking into consideration historical facts as well as the complexity of the situation. That statement contrasts one earlier this week from Russia's foreign ministry after the Russian and Chinese foreign ministers spoke by telephone. Russia said Moscow and Beijing had broadly coinciding views on the situation in Ukraine, implying that Russia had China's support for its military actions in the country. China's foreign ministry, however, has said China respects the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine and that all parties should use dialogue and negotiation to preserve peace in the region. Chinese news media coverage has been more pointed. In an editorial this week, China's Global Times newspaper stated that the Ukrainian situation shows us clearly that in the international political arena, principles are decided by power. In a commentary, China's Xinhua news agency argued that the West's biased mediation has polarized Ukraine and only made things worse in the country. Wang Dong, a professor of international relations at Peking University, says conflicting views represented by the Chinese media and government are because China has much to lose and gain with the unfolding crisis in Ukraine.
China also has a lot of stake involved because we have We also have business with Ukraine.
In recent years, Ukraine and China have formed military, trade, and agricultural partnerships. In 2012, Ukraine became the fourth largest arms exporter in the world, with many of those exports going to China. China's first aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, was built in Ukraine. Ukraine agreed last year to a deal for China to lease 5% of the country's land to grow crops and raise pigs for sale to Chinese state-owned companies. As part of that deal, China promised to build highways and bridges in the country. China also pledged $8 billion in aid during ousted Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych's visit to Beijing in December. That was in addition to $10 billion China had previously given to the country. War in Ukraine would endanger China's investments there, and China's comments this week may be a delicate balance between offering some support for its neighbor Russia without directly backing military intervention from any side that could throw the region into more chaos. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
China's top legislative body has begun its annual meetings in Beijing, where the promotion of a broad, ambitious reform agenda launched by President Xi Jinping late last year will be a top priority. The meeting marks 1 year since Mr. Xi became China's top leader and comes amid a rapidly expanding corruption crackdown as the pace of the world's second-largest economy slows. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
China's National People's Congress is the world's largest parliament with some 3,000 delegates. At the opening ceremony Wednesday, Premier Li Keqiang will deliver a speech called the Government Work Report, a lengthy address that is typically packed with not only Communist Party slogans, but clues regarding the country's policy direction. Mr. Li will also announce the government's annual target for economic growth, which is widely expected to remain at 7.5%. However, with China's economy continuing to slow and growing concerns about massive local debt, some say China's leaders could lower it to 7%. China's economy has slowed dramatically in recent years from double-digit growth. The public has also become more vocal about environmental concerns and the country's policy of growth at any cost. Over the next 8.5 days, delegates at the meeting will be discussing some 68 bills, 11 of them focusing on the environment. Skies were clear Tuesday, but just recently, Beijing's air pollution was hovering around severe levels for days. National People's Congress spokeswoman Fu Ying says environmental legislation will be a top issue during this year's meetings. Fu Ying says the problem of smog has become a symbolic and difficult issue in many cities in China, and increasingly more are being affected. But it is not just air pollution, she says. The problem of water and soil pollution is even more serious. Last fall, China's President Xi Jinping unveiled a package of reforms aimed at overhauling the economy and promoting more competition between private enterprises and state-owned monopolies, which dominate China's economy. The reforms also seek to promote rule of law and abolish long-standing policies that hinder the equal distribution of wealth in the country of 1.35 billion people. Fu Ying says it is the NPC's role to provide a legal backbone to the massive reform project Mr. Xi has initiated. She says that when it comes to major reforms of public concern, delegates should draft, revise, and abolish laws as needed to ensure that major reforms are carried out in accordance with the law. Huang Jing, professor of public policy at the National University of Singapore, says for now, it is up to China's parliament to approve the reform plan.
This is, could be especially interesting or even more difficult than previous years because the reform policies cut deep into the current political and economic structure, which means there will be a massive redistribution of power, privilege, and interests.
President Xi's reforms deliberately aim to break monopolies of what Huang calls the Iron Triangle: state-owned enterprises, the financial sector, and local governments. Mr. Xi has also taken steps, analysts say, to centralize his power. The president now heads three special committees, one on economic reform, another on security, and a third focusing on the internet. China's president has also been aggressively promoting a crackdown on corruption in the country, which analysts say can also help remove obstacles to reform. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
How to encourage U.S. students to study abroad. A new plan we'll explore later on Daybreak Asia. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama will meet with Chinese high school and college students when she makes her first trip to the Asian nation later this month. Mrs. Obama will travel to Beijing March 19th and spend several days in the Chinese capital. Her itinerary also includes visits to the central city of Xi'an and the southwestern city of Chengdu. In a message posted on the White House website Monday, the U.S. First Lady said her trip will focus on the power and importance of education, both in her own life and in the lives of young people in both countries. Well, likely she will not see protests around China, but a recent one in Hong Kong by residents there against the growing presence of mainland Chinese visitors in the city has intensified a local debate about whether authorities should regulate the influx. About 100 Hong Kong residents joined the February 16th protest, shouting insults at mainland shoppers in an upscale retail district of Kowloon Peninsula. The Hong Kong government condemned the incident and said the protesters do not represent the broader community. But frustration levels among Hong Kong residents have been rising. Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin spoke with South China Morning Post columnist Michael Chugani in Hong Kong and asked what impact the mainland visitors have had on him personally.
It's affected my daily life in many ways because I, unlike people who have private cars and chauffeurs and so on, I use public transport. And whenever I ride the MTR now or ride the bus, especially the MTR, and especially at certain stops that I have to use, it's basically full of mainland tourists. And before you could get on the MTR, you can get on a subway train when it arrives. Now, inevitably, you've got to wait two or three, sometimes even four trains before you can squeeze on. It's so packed. Rush hour is essentially gone in Hong Kong. It's rush hour all day, simply because hundreds of thousands of tourists are pouring in from across the border every day. It's affected my life in other ways. You cannot go and buy stuff in grocery stores and supermarkets because it's all cleaned out. Apartment prices are going up, shopping rents are going up. You don't get service if you go into a retail store anymore. You want to go and buy a shirt or a suit or a pair of shoes. The sales assistants, they basically just ignore you because they feel that they can do better business with the mainland tourists. So they don't even speak in Cantonese anymore. They speak in Potonghua. And if you speak Potonghua, then they'll talk to you and they'll treat you very nice. So these are the daily things that ordinary Hong Kong people, you know, it affects them.
Why do you think the government is holding back from imposing measures that would restrict or regulate mainland visitors? What forces are at work here?
Well, I'm going now into speculation. Number one, obviously the government feels that tourism is a major industry in Hong Kong. And that tourism now relies mostly on mainland visitors. That's number one. Number two, the retail sector has become totally dependent on mainland visitors. And it's created a couple hundred, 250 or 260,000 jobs. And the government feels, then why should we put a cap on travelers or visitors from mainland coming here? Because if we did that, a lot of these low-end jobs will be gone. Then that will push the unemployment rate up. So it's an easy way out. But I think also one big factor is Hong Kong is a part of China. It is not going to be easy for the Hong Kong government to tell the central government, stop your people from coming. So you cannot restrict the flow of movement. And the government is also saying, the chief executive said, if you stop them from coming, they'll stop you from going. Because the increasing number of Hong Kong people do visit the mainland over the weekend, you know, for cheap food, for karaoke, for other forms of entertainment, they do go. And there are some people who actually commute there. They work there near the border in Shenzhen, and then they come back to Hong Kong. So the government says it's a two-way street. You stop them from coming, they'll stop you from going.
And I'm also curious to know if you agree with conspiracy theories that are out there, that Beijing wants to flood Hong Kong with mainland Chinese just to make it into another Chinese city.
If I was to make a logical guess, I would say I don't think that the mainland government wants to make Hong Kong totally like another Chinese city, because Hong Kong still has its value to mainland China, being what it is now. And then if you were to be fair, the Hong Kong government did say to the mainland government, okay, you've got 49 cities in several provinces that they can come here anytime they want. The mainland government was going to expand this to even more cities, and the Hong Kong government says, please don't do that. And then the mainland government says, okay. So it did not expand the so-called individual travel scheme to more than the current 49 cities in southern China. So then in that way, they understand the frustration. But on the other hand, the Global Times, which is supposed to be a mouthpiece for the central government, a state media, did write two editorials and columns attacking the protesters, saying that Hong Kong people are psychologically crazy, Hong Kong is a part of China, and that Hong Kong people are basically jealous, they're envious because the mainlanders have become rich. That's what this editorial was, which was pretty silly. But people are interpreting that as the mainland government's disquiet over what's happening.
South China Morning Post columnist Michael Chagani in Hong Kong, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin. Be sure to follow this story with us on our Facebook page. You can like us at VOA Asia. Pakistani's Interior Minister recently presented the government's new internal security strategy. It calls for a national consensus on tackling the lethal Taliban insurgency. The Interior Minister's speech came after attempts to hold peace talks with the Taliban, which collapsed in the face of repeated militant attacks against Pakistan's security forces. Daybreak Asia's Anis Ahmed spoke with Masquith Ashan, an analyst from Karachi, Pakistan, on the outline of this new security strategy and on the reasons behind the government's tough stand against the Pakistani Taliban, or TTP.
So far, I could understand Mr. Chaudhary Nisar tried to give an idea that Pakistan government is going to solve this militancy issue by taking help from army and going for operations. But people who are not violent, only ideologically motivated, government will hold talks with them. And he tried to mention that there had been discussions among political parties, especially Muttahida Qaumi Movement, MQM of Karachi. They helped out in chalking out this new security plan, but he didn't clear out anything. As you know, this is a secret document and it should not be published or discussed that much.
Apparently, it seems that the government is taking a bit of hard line. Now, representatives of Pakistani government were holding talks with Taliban representatives. What really made the government to take this sudden U-turn?
Actually, government had been willing to resolve this matter through dialogue. And, you know, dialogue is the best way to go for any kind of solution. But when there had been talks between the government and those members from Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, initially they mentioned that they don't want to go through this process under the present constitution, which is not Islamic, and they want Sharia law to be introduced and under which they will discuss. That was one problem. On the other hand, taking part in discussions and during the same time, they created another group of militants, which is called Jundullah. They started attacking people and many targets. That means they made a plan that few people will take part into discussions and another new group will go with their militancy operation. So this double game was not really appreciated by Pakistan government. And on the other hand, they attacked Pakistan security forces members. At that point, army had to take a strong decision. And there had been discussions between army and government. So they went for this hard line and still they are adamant to do it and clean it out.
Opposition members in parliament have said that the new policy on challenging the threats of the extremists that the government has declared is very vague. How fair you think the criticism is?
I think this criticism is quite justified because nowhere in this world you can have discussions with this sort of militants who are monstrous and who are constantly attacking the nation. And you know that with IDH Republican Army, there had been no discussions. They had a political wing, Sinn Féin. With them, there had been discussions. But Tehrik-e-Taliban, Pakistan, it's a militancy group. And they don't have any political wing to discuss with. So this is quite meaningless. And what Chaudhary Nisar tried to mention, that it's a kind of a check and balance he wanted to make. But it's not working anymore. When Tehrik-e-Taliban, Pakistan, they're attacking security forces of Pakistan, that means they're straight against the sovereignty of Pakistan. In that situation, this kind of rhetorics, I think, it annoyed many experts in Pakistan.
Do you think that the Pakistan government inside and its society outside are divided within itself on how to challenge extremism in that country?
Yes, extremism has got its deep roots into the society and into the establishment. But what we could see, most of the people here in Pakistan, they are willing to clean out this mess of militancy. But inside the government, into the administration, there are people who had been associated with Jamaat and the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, and they also have this kind of mindset to go under Sharia law. Very small part of this government. So you know that this is the problem, that people, in one hand, people of Pakistan, they are willing that this problem should be resolved and government should take strong stand, and that is contradicted by those people who are inside the government or who are closely related to Jamaat and Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan. This problem is there, but this time what we could see, that army is very adamant, and already Pakistan's prime minister, he had a meeting with the chief of army staff, and both of them, they came up with the solution that yes, this problem will be resolved using strength and, you know, operations. But besides that, there will be necessary steps to have peace talks as well.
Moskwi Thoshan, an analyst from Karachi, Pakistan, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Anis Ahmed. Over 800,000 international students were studying in the United States in the 2012 to 2013 academic year, while the Institute of International Education says only 283,000 U.S. students were studying abroad. Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Daniel Ops, the Deputy Vice President for International Partnerships with the Institute of International Education, about a new five-year plan.
There's a fairly large trade imbalance, if you want to say, between the number of American students studying abroad and the number of international students coming to U.S. higher education institutions. There are far fewer Americans studying abroad. Many reasons include related to costs. For many students, it can be very expensive to study abroad, or at least they can think it's too expensive for them. In other cases, students don't study abroad because they feel it's not for them. And in other cases, it's challenging because it may not fit in the curriculum. But in many cases, those are myths. So our campaign seeks to dispel some of those myths. And we seek to work with U.S. higher education institutions on taking specific actions to help students overcome some of those obstacles.
We'll get to that in a moment. But I'm interested, especially for our audience, is there and are there cultural differences between parents and students in a country like China, sending so many people here to the United States to study? And what is it about the U.S. culture, if it is a cultural thing, that we are not doing that?
I think in many ways in China, as you give the example, not just the students, but also the parents are very eager for their students to have a higher education experience in the United States. The U.S. is still the leading destination for international students because of our excellent educational institutions, our great research that we do here, our great labs. In many cases, American students and parents think the same way. And so for them, it's a harder sell to study abroad. And that's exactly what we're trying to change. Every American student really needs to study abroad because that is what employers want and that's what they need in a global economy.
Expand on that, if you will. What is needed in a changing and expanding global economy that is offered by education overseas as opposed to staying in your own country?
Well, study abroad is one of the best ways for students to acquire global skills and competence, and that can really open up both personal but also professional opportunities. And from employers, we know that globalization is changing the way the world works, and these employers are now looking for students that have the global skills, but also soft skills, such as critical thinking or problem solving, communicating across borders and cultures, and that is what you can learn through study abroad.
But isn't that the reason why foreign students, especially from Asian countries like China, are coming here?
Exactly. That's why many foreign students are coming to the U.S., and that's why many American students need to study abroad as well.
You have mentioned the barriers, some of them being costs, some of them being cultural, some of them being just attitude, like, I don't want to go anywhere. How do you go about changing these barriers?
Very good question. And we are working with our commitment partners, now over 160 higher education institutions, to really look at what some of these very specific obstacles are. Many of our commitment partners are undertaking specific actions. For example, around funding, several of our commitment partners are actually establishing very ambitious fundraising goals. Others are setting up, for example, study abroad scholarships for students with disabilities who may not be able to go abroad usually, or for students who are underrepresented in study abroad, such as students from minority groups or from certain disciplines where they may not study abroad.
Why do we have to go there?
Well, I think the international students that come to the United States really enrich their classrooms and their communities. So it's really important for the U.S. to have more international students here. But at the same time, it's very important for American students to have that firsthand experience of living and being in a different culture, not just meeting someone from a different culture. So that is why study abroad is so important.
Daniel Ops, the Deputy Vice President for International Partnerships with the Institute of International Education, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman. We're going to take a lesson in the latest world news. Steve Norman opens up the book on International Edition next. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.